My guest Robert Wolk is an expert in kitchen science. He explains the chemical and physical principles behind the behavior of the food we cook and the utensils and appliances we cook with. Wolk writes the syndicated Washington Post column Food 101, which won the James Beard Foundation Award for Best Newspaper Column. And he has a new book called What Einstein Told His Cook. Wolk is also a professor of chemistry at the University of Pittsburgh. Sometimes you go to the fish store, you buy a fish, you take it home, and it smells fishy. And when that happens to me, I don't even know if I want to keep it, because it just shouldn't have that kind of smell. What are we smelling when we smell that fishiness? What's giving off that odor?
Largely, they are chemicals called amines. The simplest one that everyone's familiar with is ammonia itself. But amines come from the breakdown of amino acids. Amino acids, obviously from the name, have what chemists call an amino group in it. And amines are generally smelly compounds. So when the fish begins to decompose, the amino acids break down into amines, and it smells that way. If, with your scenario, if you bring it home and it smells fishy, I'd recommend buying your fish somewhere else.
If it smells fishy, does that mean you should just throw it away? Does it mean it's already bad?
Not necessarily, because getting back to our senses, our sense of smell is incredibly sensitive. And those amino compounds are very smelly. So we smell that unpleasant smell long before the fish becomes unhealthful. So a slight fishy smell is okay. If it... You'll know it when it's unhealthily decomposed. The smell will be more than you can keep in your kitchen.
Why does fish spoil so quickly?
Its muscle tissue is made of relatively thin fibers compared with the muscle fibers, let's say, in beef or pork or any land animal. And that's because they're so-called fast-contracting fibers. If you think about what a fish needs to escape a predator compared with, let's say, what a land animal needs to escape a predator, the land animal has to run like the devil, perhaps for miles, not just fast, but long distances to outrun a predator, say a lion or tiger or something. So it needs long muscles that provide long endurance. A fish, in order to escape a predator, just flips its tail faster than the eye can see and darts away. So its muscles are these very thin fibers of fast contracting muscle tissue, and these thin fibers are easier to decompose by various decomposition things, even cooking for that matter, than, let's say, beef is. And that's why fish cooks so much faster than beef, because you don't need to keep it hot as long in order to break down these muscle fibers and make it tender.
When you're buying fish at a store, do you usually smell it before buying it?
Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. I nearly got killed when I did that in Marseille, France. The fishermen were just bringing things in and selling it right there on the shore. And I wanted to buy some squid, and I just bent down and sniffed at the squid. That French fisherman had never been so insulted in his life. So I've been... And fortunately, I had a friend who could speak rapid-fire colloquial French and calm him down. But the answer is you do it when it appears to be acceptable.
You recommend using lemon to counteract the fishy smell of fish. Would you be using the lemon before you cook the fish or after it's cooked?
The reason lemon is usually served with fish in restaurants, a wedge of lemon, is that these amines that are the smell from, let's say, fish that is too fishy smelling, are alkaline. And the lemon juice is, of course, acid, which counteracts the alkaline unpleasant flavors in fish that has either been, let's say, cooked too long or wasn't as fresh as we would like to have been before it was cooked. So it generally is added afterwards. Sprinkling fish flesh with lemon juice before you cook it wouldn't do much good because it would run off and wouldn't stay long enough to do its neutralizing job.
So, gee, isn't serving lemon with fish in a restaurant almost a sign that there's a fishiness that needs to be modified by the lemon? There's something you have to counteract.
I've often asked myself that question, but I think it's just become part of our culture. It's just it's become habit, that's all. And I think probably the chefs don't even know why they put the lemon wedge on, but diners expect to see it, and there it is.
My guest is Robert Wolk, author of the new book, What Einstein Told His Cook, Kitchen Science Explained. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Wolk is my guest. He's the author of the new book, What Einstein Told His Cook, Kitchen Science Explained. In your book, you write a little bit about those non-fat aerosol sprays that you're supposed to use to prevent your eggs or your chicken or whatever from sticking to the frying pan. And on the one hand, these sprays say that they're non-fat. On the other hand, if you read the ingredients, there's oils in it. So you explain that.
Yeah, that's something funny about those things. They do say they're non-fat, and they say only 1/10 of a calorie or something like that per serving. That's one of the services I think I do for my readers in their roles as consumers outside the kitchen. It's a dodge because the Food and Drug Administration, which has to rule on how much fat can be called no fat, has a problem. I mean, if a serving contains, let's say, a gram of fat, is that no fat? If it contains only 2/10 of a gram of fat, when do we say it has no fat? Well, the manufacturers of these nonstick sprays, these non-fat sprays, which, as you point out, are fat. That's what they are. They're oils. They get around this by defining a serving. And all the FDA rules are in terms of how much of this or that one serving contains. Well, they define their servings as such a short blast of the spray that, of course, it's below the half a gram of fat that the FDA defines as permissible to say it has no fat. One major brand defines a serving as a 1/3 of a second spray. Now, who can limit his or her trigger finger to a 1/3 of a second spray? And then it also says on the label that serving is enough to cover the 1/3 of a 10-inch frying pan. All of that arithmetic manipulation is done for one purpose, just to keep the amount of fat in it, in the serving, below the half a gram that the FDA permits to be said as none.
With July 4th coming up, I thought I'd ask you about grilling food. Why does charcoal-grilled food taste so good? What's the chemical, scientific explanation for that?
It is chemical. It's not inherent to charcoal. We call it the charcoal grilled flavor, I guess because charcoal was the pretty much the only way to grill before the gas grills started becoming popular. But there's nothing about the charcoal per se that makes the flavor. What makes that charcoal grilled flavor is the very high temperature that the surface of the meat or whatever is exposed to. Grilling has to be a very high temperature, or you don't get those browned flavors that high temperatures produce. But also, some of the flavor comes from, let's say we're doing steak or hamburger or something that has fat in it, and hot dogs. That's why these are all such popular things to grill. They are fatty to some extent. And the fat will melt and drip down onto the charcoal, where it might go poof and create some smoke. And it's the smoke that, or the products from the burning fat, that rise, of course, with the heat and may deposit themselves on the bottom of the steak. So it's the fact that juices are dripping down, getting quickly incinerated, producing let's say, gases and fumes that condense on the food, and that's pretty much the what we call the charcoal flavor. But remember, I said it just has to drip down on a hot surface. That hot surface doesn't have to be charcoal, and that's why even gas grills produce the, quote, charcoal flavor, unquote, because the juices drip down on, let's say, a hot piece of ceramic or one of those volcanic stones or whatever they use, and you get the same effect.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been my pleasure.
Robert Wolk is the author of the new book, What Einstein Told His Cook. He also writes the syndicated Washington Post column, Food 101.